Welcome to the Sagebrush Trail. Stories of the West, from the frontier to the Yukon. I'm Mardell, reading Delilah of the Snows by Harold Benlar. Chapter 29. Esmond's Hands Are Tied. Grace Colthurst had not long cleared the evening meal away, but she was already waiting Esmond's departure with an impatience which was somewhat difficult to hold in check. He had come across from the outpost while she was occupied with the task, and that in itself would have been sufficient to displease her. But there were other causes for the strain upon her temper. Miss Colthurst had not expected to fare luxuriously in the Green River country, and had hitherto borne the necessary discomforts exceptionally well. But of late, she had been actually hungry, which in her case was as unpleasant as it was unusual. There was still a store of flour and salt pork in the gold commissioner's house, but there was practically nothing else, and the pork was rancid. While Grace had a very rudimentary acquaintance with the art of cookery, as one result of this, she had risen unsatisfied from each untempting meal, and brought up as she had been, the deprivation had its effect on her physical nature, though she felt the isolation which had succeeded the blockade even more. Of late the company of Ingleby or Sewell had become almost a necessity, while she had naturally not seen either of them since the miners made their protest. Colthurst had also been a trifle difficult to get on with. He was not addicted to indulgence, but neither was he particularly abstemious, and tea brewed from leaves which had been infused once or twice already was not a beverage he appreciated, or one that tended to make him more companionable. He lay somewhat wearily in a big deck chair beside the stove, with an unlighted cigar in his hand, while Esmond sat opposite him with an unpleasant look in his face. "There is nothing to be gained by hiding the fact that I am a little anxious about the state of affairs, sir," he said. "The scoundrelly miners are still apparently as far from giving in as ever, and unpleasant as it is to admit, they have the upper hand." "It looks like it," said the major dryly. "I suppose you haven't thought of making a compromise. Nobody's hurt as yet. And I fancy they would be satisfied if you met them with regard to Tomlinson. You're not bound to send a man up for trial unless it's reasonably evident that he's guilty, and I don't believe Tomlinson did the thing myself. Couldn't you hold a kind of informal inquiry and give the boys an opportunity for proving him innocent?" A vindictive sparkle crept into Esmond's eyes. "And permit a rabble of that kind to teach me my duty? I'm afraid not, even if I wasn't sure the man was guilty, which I am. The thing would be out of the question."
"You feel warranted in calling all of them rabble?" asked Grace.
"I do, every one of them. Their leaders, in particular, belong to that most intolerable class to be found anywhere, the half-taught proletariat, with just enough education to increase their natural unpleasantness and inspire them with a hatred of their superiors. That, however, is not quite the point."
The blood rose to the girl's face, but remembering that the major occasionally displayed some little penetration, she contrived to keep silent, though this was by no means easy. Colthurst, however, nodded.
"I scarcely think it is," he said with a trace of dryness. "As I pointed out once before, you do not seem to remember that I occasionally had Mr. Sewell and Ingleby here." "I'm afraid I didn't. I'm sorry, sir," said Esmond. "Of course I should have done so. One could almost have fancied that they were here frequently." Again Grace said nothing, though it cost her a stronger effort. And the major did not appear to notice the younger man's sardonic smile.
"Since you don't seem to care for my suggestion, have you any notions of your own?"
"I haven't, which is partly why I came to you. If I could only find a way of getting word to Victoria and a few more troopers in, it would be easy to bring them to reason. As it is, I have sense enough to realize that nobody would thank me for forcing a contest that could only end in disaster and the subsequent sending up of a battalion of Canadian militia. The miners are 20-1, you see." Again, Colthurst nodded. "You are right in one respect," he said. "Personally, I shouldn't care to undertake the thing with less than 3 or 4 strong companies, and I'm not sure I could get in then. Well, since a compromise appears out of the question, you can only wait events."
"That is the difficulty. I can't wait too long. We're on full ration still, but stores are getting low and certainly won't last until the thaw sets in. Of course, if affairs had been different, I could have hired enough of the fellows to break out a trail."
Perhaps the major did not intend it, but he looked at Grace and saw comprehension of his thoughts in her eyes. They were not on full rations or anything approaching it at the gold commissioner's house, and a few of the comforts Esmond could have spared would have been worth a good deal to them. He was, in some respects, not an ungenerous man, but though he must, Grace fancied, have seen how meagerly they fared, such a course had evidently never suggested itself to him. And in that fact lay the sting. He rose to go in another minute or two, but just then there was a knocking at the door, which swung open a moment later, and Grace gasped as she saw Ingleby standing on the threshold with a heavy case in his hands. His garments were ragged, and his gauntness showed through them. His face was worn and darkened by exposure to the frost, but his eyes were steady, and he glanced at the girl with a smile. There was a curious silence for a moment or two until he turned to the major.
"May I come in, sir?"
he asked. Colthurst regarded him sternly.
"You could scarcely expect me to welcome a man in arms against his country."
"No," said Ingleby, "not as a friend. That would be unreasonable. Still, I have a little explanation to make, and it is a better night to keep the door open. With your permission?" He swung round and closed it, after which he laid down the case, and Grace felt a thrill of appreciation as she watched him. His self-possession appealed to her.
"You have come alone?"
asked the major.
"Of course," said Ingleby.
Esmond smiled, though there was no good humor in his eyes, and, as if inadvertently, dropped his hand on his hip. His uniform was raised a trifle there in a fashion which suggested that a pistol lay beneath it.
"Wasn't that a little rash?" he asked. "Can you point out any reason why I shouldn't arrest you?"
"I fancy I can," and Ingleby made a gesture of impatience. "For one thing, if you attempted to lay hands on me or reached for your pistol, I should fling you out into the snow. That, of course, isn't in good taste to say in another man's house, but it may save everybody unpleasantness, and in any case, I'm one of the proletariat from whom too much is not expected." There was a harshness in his voice and a glow in his eyes which seemed to indicate that he was perfectly willing to make his promise good, while though his attitude was certainly not all that conventionality demanded, it was at least natural in the circumstances, and Grace was not displeased by it. Esmond, perhaps because he recognized the necessity for displaying his superior training, kept his temper, and Colthurst watched them both with a little grim smile. "I haven't the least intention of indulging in an exhibition of that kind, which would be quite unnecessary," said the police officer. "There's a trooper within call who has a carbine. I saw him, though being a policeman on duty, he naturally did not see me. What would you gain by calling him? I think he and I between us could take you to the outpost." "You might. I haven't a weapon of any kind with me, but what then? Two of my comrades know where I am, and you would have 30 or 40 armed miners inquiring for me before morning. It is, of course, quite plain that you can't afford to force an outbreak of that kind." Esmond realized that this was true. Ingleby, it was evident, held the cards and was quite aware of it. He wisely said nothing, though his face grew hot, and there was a wicked look in his eyes. Then Ingleby turned to the major again. "What I have to say is not in the least important and will not keep you a minute, sir," he said. "Still, there are reasons why I would sooner Captain Esmond didn't hear it." "I believe he was going when you came in," said Colthurst reflectively. The hint was plain enough, and Esmond moved towards the door, while Ingleby, who stood between him and his fur coat, handed the coat to him. Then, as the officer went out, he lifted a partly filled flour bag in from the veranda, and when he had closed the door, laid it with the case on the table. "Won't you sit down?" Grace said quietly. Ingleby looked at Colthurst. "I scarcely think Major Colthurst would object to anything you suggest, but I am in his hands." "Sit down and be hanged to you," said the major, whose face grew suddenly red. "Do you suppose I enjoy the position you forced me into?" Ingleby did as he was bidden. "I came across this case at the settlement, sir, and was told it was for you. From what the storekeeper said, I fancied Miss Colthurst would be pleased to have it, and that you wouldn't mind my bringing it up with me."
"You were at the settlement?"
And Colthurst glanced at him almost incredibly. "Perhaps you know Esmond sent down 2 or 3 troopers, and they couldn't face the snow." "Yes, sir, you will probably understand why I preferred not to mention it in Captain Esmond's presence."
"The box is proof that you were there, but how the devil you managed it is more than I know. The troopers certainly couldn't."
"They didn't go the right way," said Ingleby dryly.
"Then there's another one,"
and Colthurst flashed a sharp glance at him. "As a very little reflection would show you that there must be, there is no use in running away from the question. Besides, I feel I'm safe in your hands, and while circumstances continue as they are, Captain Esmond couldn't profit by any conclusions you might come to. Shall I open the case for you, sir?" The major made a little sign, and Ingleby, crossing to the hearth, picked up the rock drill which served as poker, and contrived to prise up the lid with it. It was a trifling action, but it was characteristic, and Grace noticed that he made use of the thing that was nearest, without troubling anybody to find him a more suitable implement. Then he laid out the contents of the box upon the table, and the girl's face softened as she watched him. The little comforts in themselves were worth a good deal to her just then. But the fact that he had thought of her was worth far more. The major, however, appeared a trifle disappointed, and she fancied she knew what he was looking for. Ingleby seemed to know it too, for there was a suggestion of a smile in his eyes. Leaning on one elbow on the table, she looked at him with her rounded chin and the palm of one hand.
"Whichever way you went, you must have crossed the range," she said. "That box was heavy. How did you carry it?"
"On my back," said Ingleby. "That is the usual way. We had sold all the horses off to the freighter for a few dollars quite a while ago. Of course, as I hadn't asked your permission, it was a liberty." Grace made a little gesture.
"What did you go down to the settlement for?"
"Provisions."
"But nobody could carry many of them over the mountains."
"I think I managed 40 pounds, said Ingleby incautiously. "Most of the boys had considerably more."
The clear color rose, crept into Grace's cheeks, and she did not trouble to prevent his seeing it. She knew what the simple admission meant and that it must have cost him toil incredible to make that journey with a double burden. It was for her he had borne it. "And the box?" she asked. Ingleby's embarrassment was evident, and she turned to the major with a curious little laugh and a faint ring in her voice. "Do you understand what Mr. Ingleby has done?" she said. "He has carried that box, besides his own load, up from the settlement, over the mountains, so that we should not suffer for anything." Colthurst also appeared embarrassed. In fact, his face was distinctly red. "I'm very much obliged to him," he said. "It's devilish unfortunate you got drawn into that outpost business, Ingleby." "Excuse me, Grace, it is unfortunate. Can't you see how you have placed me? As a man who has served his nation, even though he has been kicked for it, I can't very well." He stopped for a moment, still a trifle flushed, and then broke into a little laugh. "Well," he said, "you're too strong for me. I'll capitulate. You know the ground I ought to take as well as I do, but it's more than could reasonably be expected of any man under the circumstances. Still, that storekeeper fellow might have put in something a little more exhilarating than tea." Ingleby opened the flour bag with something as nearly approaching a grin on his gaunt face as was compatible with the deferential attitude he had assumed. "I feel a little diffident about the next proceeding, sir," he said. "In fact, it is a piece of almost intolerable presumption on the part of a man setting constituted authority at defiance, as I'm afraid I am. Still, you see, people must eat and drink in any case." He took 2 carefully wrapped bottles out of the bag, and the major's eyes twinkled, while as he spread out the rest of its contents, Grace felt her heart grow very soft towards him. He had, it seemed, thought of everything that could minister to her comfort. Then he saw that he had guessed what she was thinking, and his honesty became apparent. "The storekeeper had his wife there," he said. "I had a little talk with her." "It is to be hoped she didn't drink whiskey of that kind," said the major with a chuckle. "You couldn't get anything better in a Montreal club." Ingleby laughed. "I fancy some of my comrades have belonged to associations of the kind, and a good many of them have cultivated tastes," he said. "As a matter of fact, they can afford them." "Will you be good enough to tell me how much these things cost?" asked the major. "If you insist. In fact, there's an invoice here. Still, after the little kindnesses you have shown me, I would much sooner not let you see it." Colthurst looked up at him sharply, and then, reaching out, laid his hand upon the grocery bill. After that, he rose and went into the adjoining room, and when he came back, he handed Ingleby a check on a Vancouver bank. Grace watched the miner curiously as he did so. "Now you have relieved your feelings, sir. I can make what use I like of what is my own," he said. He crossed the room and flung the paper into the fire, then turned with a little smile to the major. It was a bold step, and the boldness of it appealed to the girl. She understood it as an assertion of equality, something he owed to himself, and withal it was done with deference and not aggressively. For a moment, Colthurst gazed at him in astonishment.
Then he laughed and made a little sign of comprehension.
"I'm not sure I've met many young men with nerve enough to do that, but I think you're right," he said. "I was pleased to make your acquaintance, Mr. Ingleby, and it is perhaps not altogether your fault that the present unfortunate circumstances must necessarily lead to a temporary break in it."
Ingleby made him a little grave inclination. "I understand, sir, and there is only one thing I would like to ask," he said. "We may make some suggestions shortly for a compromise, and in view of Captain Esmond's temperament and our own, they might be considered more dispassionately if passed through a third party. Would you be willing to receive Sewell here?" He was evidently about to go, and Colthurst held out his hand.
"Send him as soon as you can. If your ideas are reasonable, I'll do my utmost with Esmond. This state of affairs can't go on."
Ingleby turned towards the door, but Grace, who was waiting, opened it for him and let her hand rest in his a moment.
"Walter," she said very softly, "it was exactly what I would have expected from you."
Ingleby did not think it advisable to turn round, but he gripped the little fingers hard as he passed out into the darkness. Join me next time on the Sagebrush Trail for more exciting Western adventure in Delilah of the Snows by Harold Binlaw.